Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by David Cloutier, professor of theology in the Department of Theology at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., and author of Love, Reason, and God's Story, An Introduction to Catholic Sexual Ethics, and Walking God's Earth, The Environment and Catholic Faith. He'll speak on the topic, The Vice of Luxury, Economic Excess in a Consumer Age. His remarks were given as part of Creighton's Business, Faith, and Common Good lecture series. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, November 1st, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Andy Gustafson, Associate Professor of Business Ethics and Society in Creighton's Hyder College of Business.
This is the fifth Business, Faith, and the Common Good public talk that we've had in the lecture series this fall. I'm very happy to bring to you a friend of mine, David Cloutier. I've met him at a couple different conferences and heard him give presentations. He is a professor at Catholic University of America in the theology department. He especially teaches ethics. In addition to numerous academic articles, he's written Love, Reason, and God's Story, An Introduction to Catholic Sexual Ethics in 2008, and also Walking God's Earth, The Environmental and Catholic Faith. But his most recent work is in 2015, and it was The Vice of Luxury, Economic Excess in a Consumer Age. It's been very well received. He gives a historical account of the concept of luxury, shows why luxury is a problem, and explains how to identify what counts as a vice of luxury today, developing an ethic of consumption that's grounded in Christian moral convictions. I found the book to be very enlightening, very challenging, and I'm grateful that he was willing to come here to us tonight. So would you please welcome Dr. Cloutier.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Gustafson. And I will say that I never thought I would be giving an academic lecture while the Cubs are playing in the World Series. But I'm happy that I will be thinking of it throughout the lecture because of, yes, I will be thinking of it. But I will be focused. So thank you for coming out tonight. I hope I give you some things to think about. And I want to wake you up at the beginning of this lecture so you can start thinking about coffee. Do you like coffee? I like coffee. But I especially like coffee shops, which are great places on weekend mornings to write guest lectures. Being new in Washington this semester, I have been searching out good coffee shops. And a few weekends ago, I discovered Phil's Coffee. It's P-H-I-L-Z. Phil's Coffee. Phil's slogan is one cup at a time. So they only do elaborate pour-overs for each customer. You can't actually, there's no coffee there, right? They actually pour the water over your own individualized little thing of coffee. And behind the counter, there's a dazzling list. This is an old list. The one they have now in D.C., there was about 36 different coffees you could choose. And you walk up, you get your own personal barista, and you tell him or her which blend you want, and they get to work handcrafting your personal cup of coffee. The one I had made a big show about pouring over the water like it was cool or something. And after a few minutes, I got my 16-ounce coffee in a paper mug. They don't actually have real mugs. For the fine price of $4.50, there was no latte element to this. It was just coffee. For $4.50 plus 10% DC restaurant tax. So it was almost $5 for a 16-ounce cup of coffee. So I did love the space for work, and I got a ton done. But do I really need 40 different coffees to choose from on a Saturday morning? And is one cup at a time really all that much more tasty than Starbucks coffee out of an urn? Why does Phil's Coffee exist as a business model when at other times in our society, people seem to complain endlessly about not having enough money? Perhaps the core problem is that we don't know because we've lost the language to express when it is appropriate to stop, when to say to Phil's, enough is enough. We are like the person who drinks 2 beers, feels great, and thinks that if he drinks 10 beers, he will feel 5 times as great. We've lost a sense for a virtue commended by Pope Francis in the concluding chapter of Laudato Si, the virtue he calls sobriety, which is not actually about drinking either. Happy sobriety, as he calls it, is defined as the conviction that less is more. It is not a lesser life, he says, or one lived with less intensity, but rather a different way of living life to the full. In what I take to be the particular teaching gift of his papacy, Francis juxtaposes two striking images. One of a person who spends their life dipping here and there. Think about 40 different coffees to choose from every morning. Always on the lookout for what they do not have. And the other person living a life with the ability to appreciate every person and each thing, learning familiarity with the simplest things and how to enjoy them. And Francis sums this up: people who live this virtue, even living on little, they live a lot. Right? The Pope's words here reflect well the basic claim I want to make and defend in this talk, which is that economic restraint is an essential component of the Catholic moral vision for good economies. We need the virtue of economic restraint, and yet we have lost effective language in moral theology to address this problem. In particular, we have lost the ability to name the vice of excess in relation to the virtue of restraint, the vice that is traditionally called luxury. The term luxury has a strange history. For most of its life, it was seen as a critical term, like greed. But today, it's a ubiquitous advertising slogan. I think every DC apartment building advertises itself as luxury apartments in one way or the other. There are reasons why this language of vice fell into neglect, and I'll mention them briefly tonight. But more importantly, I want to argue for the urgency of recovering this language. Pope Francis, like his predecessors, criticizes this narrative of the limitless expansion of wants. And yet, this narrative is a central and perhaps the most unquestioned element of our dominant social culture. Historian Brad Gregory argues that this vision, which he calls the goods life, functions as the cultural glue which holds Western societies together, he says, amidst the hyperpluralism of our fragmented philosophical commitments. As Gregory puts it, there is an assumption that whatever people's beliefs about the big life questions, people in every culture and religion and political party will want more and better stuff, and that this endless process is a road to happiness. In our culture, the coastal elites and the rural working class may not agree on much right now, but we can all come together and want the latest iPhone. Right? We should be struck by how rarely anyone dares criticize this narrative. In the public square, no candidate of either party touches this, nor are we likely to hear in Sunday homilies words like the following: "In the beauty of your house's ornaments, you put your pride and make idols of them, but God will make refuse of them." That's the prophet Ezekiel. Okay. Imagine this in a homily: "What will you tell the judge, you who dress up your house's walls and leave your brother naked, or groom and adorn your car?" I changed this a little bit to make it up to date. "Or groom and adorn your car while your brother suffers, or throw away food while your brother starves. The naked cries out to you, yet you are perplexed by the choice of marble to clothe your floors." That's the church fathers, St. Basil and Ambrose. These are the words of the prophets and the church fathers. And their target is not our daily ordinary material consumption, but a variety of unnecessary and excessive goods on which we spend time and resources. How many of the people in an average congregation openly have cars or homes that would quite evidently be challenged by this kind of preaching? So in tonight's presentation, I want to make three large claims that are necessary for facing this problem honestly and constructively. The first is definitional. What exactly would constitute luxury? The inability to name it with more clarity can undermine the point right from the start. The second claim explains how a critique of luxury is essential, or of the essence of for sustaining the basic principles of Christian economic ethics. The final part of the paper is economic. Can a critique of luxury be sustained in the face of objections that luxury is good for the economy, that people spending on unnecessary goods is good for other people. In our brief time today, I will only skim the surface of these questions, but I'll look forward to some time for Q&A and then with seminar folks afterwards. All right, first, definition. What exactly is the classic critique of luxury that we find in the ancient philosophers, that we find in the Bible? At the most basic level, to call something a vice is to say that it is a disposition that hurts us. Us in terms of each of us who might have the vice. It hurts us to have the vice. And us in a collective sense. It hurts us as a community. This is the basic structure of the critique in ancient writers beginning in Plato's Republic. Luxury names a disposition which is degrading to the human person themselves and destructive to the society. It degrades the person because it allows the person's desires to run beyond the limits that are set by human nature. Luxury involves wanting more in ways that are detrimental to our individual flourishing. To use a simple example, we all know that at some point, having more and more stuff forces us to take more and more time to manage that stuff. It doesn't actually make our lives easier, it makes our lives harder. And it distracts us from more important goals in life. Research clearly supports the fact that when we have too many choices, we actually end up less happy overall with whatever we choose. We could call it the fear of missing out syndrome, right? The more choices you have, the more worried you are that you're not making the best possible choice, and therefore the less happy you are with where you end up going to college, for example. This is a point actually made by Aquinas 800 years ago in distinguishing what he calls natural from artificial wealth. Now, in terms of harming society, luxury divides the social body, especially by diverting excess wealth from its more suitable purpose, which is splendid public works that are for the whole society, like colleges. The few who actually have excess resources in the ancient world must do things with those resources to build up civic life. For example, they ought to contribute to public baths, not private swimming pools in their country villas. Luxury increases the visibility of inequality. That is, people see and feel the inequality when people buy excessive goods. And then that produces, Plato says, it's still true today, unnecessary civic conflict. Everybody wants a pool in their backyard. Once some people get a pool in their backyard, other people want it in their backyard. Not everybody can have a pool in their backyard. So then we start having conflicts. The biblical sources, especially in the Old Testament, spin the personal degradation more in terms of idolatry. That is, we tend to substitute goods and attention to goods for God. And the social division in terms of a neglect of the poor, which is to say that because we have material possessions, we don't actually give goods to people who need basic necessities. In brief, luxury draws us away from love of God and neighbor. But notice that this twin critique of individual debasement and social division remains the basic form. The prominence of the critique of luxury has waxed and waned over time. I cover much of this in my book, but for this talk, I only want to focus on one crucial crisis in 18th century England. In the emerging capitalist economy of the time, there was much concern over luxury. People criticized luxury and said it led to social decay. But the term became a catch-all for any new social behavior that received criticism. One author of the time uses the term luxury to explain dozens of contemporary problems, from, quote, shoddy construction to increases in tea drinking to the debauchery of farm boys. It would be like today somebody saying, oh, our society is terrible today, and they will be like, Snapchat is terrible, and Tinder is terrible, and it's a luxury, and video boards at Wrigley Field are terrible, and they're a luxury. And it everything is put into one pot. And so what happens, of course, is the word comes to cover everything and therefore means nothing. Right? The term empties of its meaning. In a similar way, new economic thinkers like Bernard Mandeville started trying to defend luxury on the grounds that this private vice, in fact, led to massive public benefit, that spending produced more spending and more circulation, and that this was helpful to the economy. His argument was supported, though, by his definition of luxury, which he said was anything that is not immediately necessary to make man subsist as he is, as a living creature. any less rigorous definition, Mandeville said, and we won't know where to stop. Of course, once everything beyond bread and water and a cave becomes luxury, then again, the term basically covers everything and it loses its meaning. In developing a contemporary definition that's more precise, that can recover a sense of what luxury is so that it doesn't cover everything, I turn to the Scottish political economist Andrew Ferguson. Ferguson astutely bypasses the pitfalls of defining specific objects as luxury, like I was harshing on the iPhone before. That's not really the point, right? Instead, he focuses on why this overall disposition is ruinous to the human characters. The point is not to critique this or that new thing, but rather to identify how people's characters are changing because of the consumption choices that they're making. So Ferguson identifies three specific problems that mark the vice. First, a tendency to shrink from small inconveniences in doing one's work. If one has a disposition to not get the job done because it's just too hot in the office today, for example, he would think, oh, that person has the vice of luxury. They can't deal with the fact that the office gets hot and cold and it's not perfect all the time. A second mark of the vice is an improper admiration for paltry distinctions, whether you have a Samsung phone or an iPhone. And it really matters. Like that, you really care about that. And then finally, a preference for such trivialities as the principal objects of human life over other more obvious goods such as friends, countrymen, and humanity as a whole. That is to say, he assumes that love of country, love of friends is much more important than worrying about whether you have this phone or that phone. And a mark of the vice of luxury is you actually spend more time worrying about which phone you have than worrying about these other more important things. In all three of these problems, there is some kind of a disposition to disordered priorities. This disordered prioritization of goods is a characteristic of all sorts of sin. What distinguishes the vice of luxury is its overall preoccupation with these material distinctions of all sorts. So in my book, I update Ferguson by defining luxury as the disposition to use our surplus resources for the inordinate consumption of private goods and services in search of, and this is kind of what we're aiming at, ease, pleasure, novelty, convenience, or status. So there's two really crucial elements that I want to highlight here. One is the distinction between necessity and surplus. This is the recognition that luxury concerns choices we make about surplus resources. If this is true, then we must have some way to retain a definition of the difference between what is necessary and what is extra. And a good amount of the last part of my text is devoted to a lengthy exploration of our ability to make this distinction. The other crucial element of the definition is the notion of inordinate, which emphasizes, as Ferguson's does, that luxury is seen not simply in itself, but in terms of some disordered trade-off, right? It's about inordinate as disorder, right? That somehow the choices that you have made, they're not bad in themselves, but they're bad because what you've done is you've traded off something less important you've traded off something more important for these less important things. Luxury is not simply about too much per se, but about wrong ways of dealing with the situation of having too much. It's not about having too much wealth, but about different dispositions for using your excess wealth. This definition allows me to move to the second big claim of the talk, that identifying the vice of luxury is crucial for Christian economic ethics overall. How so? Why is it essential? Well, because a definition of luxury is necessary to understand two central concepts in Catholic social thought: the universal destination of goods, and then a second one I'm going to talk about in a minute, the sacramentality of the material world. The universal destination of goods is really the heart of all Catholic economic ethics. It's an idea that people often ignore or even reject. The universal destination of goods is the claim that God made the material world for everyone, for all people. And so the goods of the world are destined, aimed at, everyone. Thus, private property should be used for the benefit of the whole. That is, private property is not an end in itself, but rather a means to the end of the universal destination of goods. Now, of course, this includes oneself and one's immediate dependents. So according to the Catholic Catechism, private property, quote, is legitimate for helping each person meet his basic needs and the needs of those in his charge. Okay, basic needs. But beyond this point, private property should, quote, allow a natural solidarity to develop between men by communicating the benefits of property to others. Okay. The common good, broadly speaking. Thus, there are two moral claims on our use of material possessions: that it be used to meet basic human needs for ourselves and our families. We need food. We need basic shelter. We need to have these things for our dependents. We need to educate our dependents. And then that it be used in ways that promote larger human solidarity. Beyond our needs, we should use the goods to promote solidarity in various ways. What's clear is it's not supposed to be used for excess pleasures of the self, right? That's clearly what's missing from the concept of the universal destination of goods. I find that people are shocked by this notion as an overriding principle which is supposed to subordinate claims to private property. Yet this principle is bedrock teaching. It's not something new. Francis in Laudato Si calls it the golden rule of social conduct and quotes John Paul II in identifying it as, quote, the first principle of the whole ethical and social order. How does it relate to the critique of luxury? Well, to be kind of obvious, right? This idea, if we put it into practice, clearly requires a delineation between basic necessities and superfluous spending. It does not indicate socialism or communism, not in any way. It accepts private property, but it assumes that right stewardship of private property involves restraint in consumption by the primary owner. That is, you should restrain your consumption to your basic needs so that you can serve others with the rest. One must be able to make reasonable distinctions between what I and my family need and what would be luxurious, because that luxurious stuff could be put at the service of other people in some way. Some claim that this distinction between needs and luxuries is impossible. Who's to say what is a need? But in fact, no society exists without making some rough and pretty obvious distinctions. And in fact, we all do this in our ordinary lives too. Like at times when we have too little money, we know what to cut out. We think, oh, I can't do that. Well, there you go, right? We've made the distinction. For example, many states don't charge sales tax on certain items that are considered necessities. Food is the most obvious example. We have food pantries in most communities and emergency housing available for people, but we don't have donations of vacations and video games. Those are obviously luxuries. For many years, family budget studies have sought to determine things like a living wage by making these distinctions. What does a family actually need to live on, and what would it be nice for them to have but is not absolutely necessary? What these studies of budgets generally agree on is that a budget needs to provide for four key necessities: food, shelter, transportation, and medical care. Then they usually add in some kind of a residual for the remaining basket of goods and services. You need to buy pens at Staples occasionally, and you need to buy household cleaners at Target or something like that. For a family of four, two parents and two children, we can consider the following amounts. There's lots of research behind this in the book. Those are reasonable, average ballpark figures that would obviously vary a little bit whether you're renting in Omaha or renting in Washington, D.C., for example. But nevertheless, these are reasonable figures. And including some wiggle room here, right, we were going to get to $42,000, we can posit a kind of basic necessities number for a family of four. That's probably like that number, just an easy number to remember, right? $50,000 for a family of four. Now, this is a discussion starter, not a discussion stopper. But we should recognize that in our society, this is pretty near the median income. The median income in our society is pretty near $50,000. But many full-time workers make more like that number, right? That's $15 an hour, 2,000 hours. That's $30,000 a year. That's typical for security guards and the people who answer phones at call centers. And these kinds of very basic, lower-skill jobs are are making $30,000 a year. And yet they have families, they're not even at that number. And yet many people in our society are at more like that number. Many people, I know people, who are families of four, make about this, and they feel like they're just getting by. They feel like they have very little margin for error. And so the point here is not to define the vice of luxury in terms of a monetary number. That clearly requires the virtue of prudence, because individual situations do vary. But my overall point is the need to wrestle with the moral importance of prudently naming necessity so that we can follow the universal destination of goods. If we're going to support a wage that means that a family should live on that, then the people who are living on that clearly have luxuries, because they believe that a family can live on that, right? So if they believe that that will cover the necessities, then something in their life is beyond necessity, right? Because they're not just spending $30,000 on necessities. Now, the point is not to give away all the rest. Rather, the point is to consider the moral responsibilities that are borne by the rest. Beyond necessity resources are not simply morally neutral. We can't just spend them on whatever we want. Rather, they have moral responsibilities attached to them. We can use them well or badly, with virtue or vice. Benedict XVI's insistence on quotas of gratuitousness, even within market transactions, is a crucial example of this. The beauty of charity, of gift-giving, can't just be something that happens outside the market. It has to be part of our actual economic lives. So, my second point, beyond the universal destination of goods. Excess goods, goods that go beyond our daily bread, are meant to have spiritual, we might say sacramental, possibilities. The claim that the Catholic tradition makes most broadly about sacrament, right, is that the material mediates the spiritual. You get to Jesus through the bread and wine, right? Not apart from it, not in some kind of spiritual space, but the material mediates the spiritual. Now, how does this relate to luxury? Well, ironically, this basic Catholic truth is distorted into idolatry precisely by the contemporary marketing of luxury. Luxury, as advertised to us every day, is an alternative kind of spirituality, an alternative, not sacramental, way in which material goods are supposed to fulfill us beyond their materiality. The literature on luxury branding is filled with claims verging on or entering into the spiritual. For example, one group of researchers says that luxury is more than a characteristic or a set of attributes. No matter how hard you look at a Cartier bracelet, you won't be able to identify what makes it a luxury product. What makes it a luxury product is invisible. It sounds very spiritual. And another marketing manual says that luxury, making your product a luxury product, is about a feeling or an emotionally satisfying experience, one that, quote, corresponds to a dream. Thus, it goes beyond functionality, for dreams, quote, do not necessarily need to be satisfied because they exist outside time and often last forever. Very spiritual sounding. Luxury car ads are easy targets on this one. This is an Infiniti ad, right? And if you want a theological claim, right, we can see that the Infiniti will set you free. Because the Infiniti says you will own the feeling of pure liberation because you own the sky. What could that possibly mean? Right? What that is playing on is it's playing on spirituality. It's playing on the same tune that Catholic sacramental theology wants to play on. And then Jaguar has this slogan, "How alive are you?" Right? Clearly, again, suggesting that this is more than a car. This is going to give you some kind of, grace, spiritual gifts. How alive are you? Is a spiritual claim. So what I want to emphasize here is the marketers are right to say that the material mediates the spiritual. They just have it wrong in terms of what they mean by the material mediating the spiritual. This marketing of transcendence is most strongly associated with truly elite brands, but many more ordinary products follow on the same path in order to achieve a pricing premium from us. For example, authors agree that Apple has done this extremely well and that its objects are designed not simply for functionality, but as somehow magical and endowed with a kind of glow, which is why we spend more money on them, not simply because of what they do. Now, what might be the alternative to the use of excess wealth for luxury brands? Some of this simply involves paying more for necessities. So a vision of the sacramental possibilities of ordinary economic exchanges and institutions and relationships is really what CST calls for. But these emotionally satisfying goods and services must counter the illusions set up by luxury goods and services. So pay more for gift, not for luxury. And so farmers markets are an easy target for this too, right? You're actually doing something personal at a farmer's market, right? And it's economically helpful to the farmer, I just want to point out. But in fact, it's also good on a number of other levels, right? It's creating community on a number of other levels. I'd rather that Phil's Coffee give me a mug and assure me that their coffee is fair trade rather than give me the elaborate pour over, right? Charge me the extra money, but charge it for the right reasons. Charge it for genuinely sacramental reasons, not fake advertising sacrament reasons. But some of this also recognizes that we can use our beyond necessity goods for communion rather than for private luxury in other ways. The most obvious way is through investing in shared goods rather than private ones. No one's going to drive your Jaguar, right? I mean, only really unique people are going to. Your Jaguar is yours. You are not going to share your Jaguar, right? Investing in shared goods can be about things like libraries and parks and public goods, but it can also simply be about community sharing. Like, will you have a car that when your neighbor needs to drive it, you'll be like, oh, sure, go ahead. Or a lawnmower, where your neighbor says, can I borrow your lawnmower? And you're like, yeah, it's okay. And if you have a really fancy lawnmower, are you going to say that? Maybe not. A second way to use our goods in a more sacramental way is recognizing that there are times for celebration that can appropriately call for going beyond necessity. I call these in the book festival goods, and the obvious example is spending on weddings. There's a whole industry there, too, that's subject to some critique. But obviously, to spend a lot of money to celebrate a special occasion is not a bad thing. The problem is when you want the special occasion to be every day. So the key distinction here is occasional spending is not luxury spending because it doesn't shape us. It's the habitual indulgence that not only ruins our appreciation of the material but ruins us by making us more and more focused on paltry distinctions. How does this relate? Well, an example. The fact that we go on vacation at a luxury resort might not be a problem, but wanting to wake up every morning in a bedroom that feels like I'm at a luxury resort would be a problem. Now, in saying all of this, won't this wreck the economy? Won't this just be a disaster? Time for part three. We have to think about economics here. We have to take actual economics seriously. We can't just make these prophetic claims in Christian social ethics. They just are sentimental platitudes if we don't look at how the world actually works. The rise of modern economics has generally made the above case against luxury difficult. The conventional wisdom is that consumption is necessary for economic activity to continue and that depressed demand would mean a depressed economy. Moreover, spending generates investment, which increases productivity, which enhances overall welfare for everyone in the long run. Therefore, the message, not my message, but the society's message is spend on yourself for the common good, right? All this spending is actually for the common good. Now, there are two limitations to this basic idea that I want to explain at all too simple a level here. One is a failure to distinguish the overall collective effects of different sorts of consumption. And the second is a false belief that so-called productivity growth that we have benefited from in the last century can just be repeated over and over again. Okay, let's talk a little bit about each of these. First, not all consumption is created equal. As has long been noted, aggregating all consumption in economic measurement could mean increases in spending on bad things rather than good things. Say you have more sick people in your society. Great, more hospital spending. It's good for the economy, but clearly not good for the society, right? More crime? Great, more police, more private security systems, but not good for the economy. We'd all rather not have the private security system and be able to walk around the block and not have the crime in the first place. But in terms of luxury, right, beyond spending on bads, right, The crucial distinction is a lesser known idea about the positionality of goods and services. For non-positional goods, capitalist logic, the idea that we spend on our own self-interest and it improves the market, it improves productivity, the baker becomes a better baker, everybody bakes like the baker that all the customers go to, therefore we have more bread for everyone. This does, in fact, make more bread for everyone because it leads to these productivity increases which lower the cost of the good. Moreover, for non-positional goods and services, your own consumption is independent of what others consume. The fact that I like this bread has nothing to do with the bread that somebody else is eating. Markets then reflect an efficient level of production based on people's actual needs, not more and not less. This is clearly a virtue of markets. But positional goods are inherently zero sum. You don't get more bread by everybody seeking their favorite bread. So you can produce more houses, but you can't produce more houses on the metro line. This is an example from Washington, D.C., because there's a limited amount of metro line. You sort of can and sort of can't. Big debate underneath that. You can produce more good schools, but you can't produce more of the best schools because there's only a limited number of schools that can be the best schools. So if everybody's competing for the best schools, right, people are spending more and more money to get their kids into the best schools, but nobody's getting ahead. The money's just holding position for people. Moreover, positional consumption is dependent on what others are consuming. So to use an example, if others start having kitchens with a given feature, let's say granite countertops, your kitchen cannot but lose position insofar as you think about kitchens as positional, unless you too get a granite countertop. Although if everyone was satisfied with their kitchen, then you also would be satisfied. Because what you actually want is you want a kitchen that is about as nice as other people's kitchens. So if other people don't upgrade their kitchen, you won't upgrade their kitchen, and all that economic activity can go into something more interesting than granite countertops. But as soon as a few people get the granite countertop, then you're like, well, my kitchen's not as nice as theirs, and I gotta have like as nice as other people's kitchen, so I'll get a granite countertop too. And so, but then nobody has actually gained anything. You had an equally nice kitchen 20 years ago, right? And now your kitchen is equally nice as your neighbor's 20 years later, but it cost you a lot more money. That's just a waste of resources that could go into something better for the society. The key point that economists like Fred Hirsch and Robert Frank make about advanced economies is that we all devote a bigger and bigger share of our national income to these positional competitions, but that the old logic of self-interest producing gains for all no longer works. Instead, you get more and more spending. Frank calls the spending that I just described on countertops expenditure cascades. TV sets are like this now too, right? TV sets actually last for 20 years, but now, since you judge your TV set relative to the TV set other people have, right? If everybody's changing their TV set every 3 years, you feel like you need to change your TV set every 3 years as well. But you don't actually get anything better. You just get an equal TV set to the other people's TV set. The point about positional goods should help us recognize that the common good in advanced economies may require different sorts of behavior, most importantly, collective restraint, than did the economy of, say, early 19th century Britain. Now, there's a second related reason here why we need to pay attention to managing our consumption, the end of what economists call productivity growth. There's absolutely no doubt that over the last 200 years, living standards have grown enormously and that much of this growth is beneficial. Pope Francis notes in his Environment encyclical, nobody is suggesting a return to the Stone Age, neither am I. But as economist Robert Gordon outlines exhaustively in his recent book, The Rise and Fall of American Growth, the productivity growth that we harnessed, especially from 1870 to 1970, involves a series of one-time-only changes that can't be repeated. This is because productivity growth at a basic level involves being able to produce more necessary goods with less time and labor, thus freeing up the labor for other work. In 1870, more than half the country farmed in order to feed the population. Today, less than 1% does. In 1870, most clothing was made and repaired in-house, which took a lot of time. In 1870, many households did not have running water, And so women especially spent a great deal of time and energy that they now spend on other things, just hauling clean and dirty water around. What Gordon emphasizes is the scale of the changes made by the possibilities of electrification, centralized water supplies, centralized heat so you didn't have to bring in the wood, by transportation efficiencies, that these gains were enormous. And as slick as some of our current technology is, it can't do much more than deliver tiny gains. That farm efficiency was a gain of 50, right? And Amazon may be slightly more efficient than Walmart, Uber may be slightly more efficient than taxis, but not by anything like a factor of 50. Like, we're just not getting the same economic gains. This is the predicted productivity growth in our lifetimes, right? It does not look like the last century that we lived through, where there is this growing productivity growth. It looks like a declining productivity growth, and that is simply because we cannot repeat the kinds of leaps that we made, not in any economically realistic way. So what this means, of course, is that with 1870 to 1970 growth, right, in a rapidly growing economy, this works, right? You can get the rising tide that lifts all boats. What this means is that you can fix the problem of the people below by simply improving the whole apparatus, but not by asking for much from the people above. But in a slow growth economy, right, where we don't have the same productivity growth, this doesn't work. The pie's not expanding as fast. And indeed, in a highly positional economy, even the 100,000 people feel poor. So their desired housing, for example, gets priced higher and higher. Thus, economist Fred Hirsch explains that as our economy becomes richer, paradoxically, it becomes harder and harder to carry out that redistribution. So in this situation, obviously, the people with $100,000 have to share with the 30,000 people, and we probably all get closer to the 50,000 people. Don't assume that the only or best way to do this is through government redistribution. That is exactly what I'm not saying, actually. I'm saying the alternative to that. Government transfers matter. However, they are notorious and true limits to both their effectiveness and their political plausibility. Instead, my analysis makes the circulation involved in consumption choices themselves a collective action problem, which is to say we all have to take on our own individual choices in terms of circulating this money and doing it more effectively. We need virtuous spending, not state redistribution, or not only state redistribution. In fact, government policies won't achieve virtuous spending. Policy responses to consumption problems like this are notoriously problematic. So in the ancient world, attempts at things like sumptuary codes that would limit the amount of money that rich people were able to spend on things tended to shift the spending to areas that were just not covered by the codes. So rich people were engaged in positional competition, so they would stop spending on the things there were laws against and start spending on something else. Today, social reformers are faced with data from behavioral economics that people don't actually get happier with increased consumption, but they are very concerned about actually making laws that would force you to consume in a way that would make you happier. How does that sound? The government is going to force you to consume in a way that you will be happier. It just sounds horrible to people, right? The name that one advocate of this gives to it is non-coercive paternalism. It's double speak. I'm for virtuous spending, right? I'm for us doing this ourselves rather than having these kinds of spending choices forced. Charles Taylor argues that genuine moral thought requires a language of strong evaluation of noble and base in order for agents to retain a depth without which a person would be shallow. Luxury is a language that for much of Western history brought this sense of depth and significance to our use of economic surpluses, directing the wealthy away from actions that were simply wasteful and selfish and towards actions that were better for the society. Ultimately, it's difficult to have this conversation without some kind of a distinction, like Stuart Chase is a 1920s economist who distinguished between wealth and ill. He tried to figure out how much of our economy was taken up by things that were unnecessary and how much was taken up by what was necessary, and a way to kind of divide those, perhaps, tax one but not the other, for example. Or Arthur Pigou's did distinction between economic welfare and social welfare. Contemporary economists need to develop better distinctions like this in order for us to succeed collectively economically. So I want to end this presentation, which is guilt-inducing, and I'll just let you know it's just as guilt-inducing for me as it is for other people, with a confession. These are three people whom I would consider among my spiritual heroes. Thomas Merton left a promising and exciting life as a young writer and a professor to join the Trappists in rural Kentucky. Dorothy Day, on the right, pursued many different directions in her life before meeting her mentor, Peter Morin, and spending the rest of her life living among the poor in Catholic worker houses. And, of course, Mother Teresa of Calcutta poured out her life day by day among the poorest people on the face of the earth, tending to them with an intensity and patience that seemed never to fail, and doing it through a great darkness of the soul, as we now know from her spiritual journals. These three truly follow Jesus' command to leave everything, sell possessions, and follow him. Right? And my confession is, I don't want to do that. That's my confession. I don't want to do what these people did, and that's part of the reason I did this project. Because the good news, I think, is that in order to practice real discipleship with our possessions, we don't need to literally give away every single one of them. But we can't just wave off all of our riches with some story about spiritual detachment either. Even Christians in the world need to learn how to practice discipleship with their possessions, and that includes disciplining ourselves against the vice of luxury. Turning from that, we can be liberated to see how even in our daily economic lives, we might spend our money and use our goods for something else, for exchanges of grace that eventually build up different sets of relationships with other people and a different kind of economy, an actually sacramental economy rather than one that gives us a lot of luxury. So thank you, and I'll welcome your questions.
Good. Thank you very much. Does anyone have a question or a thought they wanted to share with Professor Clotier?
Hi, my name's Connor. I just have a question regarding how do you distinguish between purchasing things that are made with quality versus purchasing things that would be considered luxurious?
Yeah. Connor offers a great question. I think that that's a very valuable distinction. I actually think that buying cheap goods that you have to basically dispose of repeatedly and spend, besides the environmentally bad effects, that's actually more like luxury. Like if we think about our stereotypes of rock stars or Kim Kardashian or something, we picture them just throwing things away randomly. Yet we kind of are able to do that about a lot of things. So in fact, spending on quality is good. The important thing to recognize there, though, is if you're going to spend on quality, don't buy a Jaguar, right? I don't think so. Check the consumer reports. Yeah, I pretty much know what quality car you should buy, right? You all probably know like what car should you buy if you want quality? Toyota or Honda, right? No question about it, right? I got a Civic, 16 years. I've never had a major repair on it. It's 177,000 miles. The thing will run forever, right? That anecdotal evidence, not very good evidence. But look at Consumer's Reports. It will tell you, right, why you would buy a non-quality car is somewhat mysterious. And you do actually have to pay more for quality cars, right? A little bit more. But that's distinguishable from luxury. So,
other questions?
Hi, my name is Alex. I'm a senior here at Creighton. And I was wondering if you could touch a bit on the luxury of property.
The luxury of property. Can you say a little bit more about
just in terms of
having like
renting versus buying, not only like property as in land, but even just like having lots of things, like from that perspective. Because I think that was one of the things you touched about in your paper.
Obviously, one of the biggest expenditures that most ordinary middle class and upper middle class people will make in a society has to do with buying property or a home. And the home will set a standard for your expectations. The bigger the rooms, the more you will get used to big rooms being normal. And therefore, the more you will need rooms to be of a certain size in order for you to feel comfortable, for example. There's an effect that they call the hedonic treadmill in some of this happiness literature that suggests that if you constantly upgrade your experience, what happens is you feel good about the new car for a certain period of time, and then the new car becomes just your car. Like, it's just normal, right? So you get enjoyment out of this upgrade for a short time, and then you kind of revert to ordinary. And if you want to get that same feeling again, you got to upgrade again, right? So I think for property, the most important thing is to try to set your standards at a modest, reasonable level right from the start. And then you won't be seduced into some of these other things. The other thing is positional competition. People do judge their houses based on what other people's houses look like. I know my father would come back from people's houses and be like, why would they waste their money on that? And he would not come back and he would say, oh, they have such a beautiful kitchen. I want to get that kitchen too. They would be like, why would you waste your money on something? I guess I inherited that.
Thank you.
Two questions. One, does the whole interest in luxury have any implications for, you know, income and wealth inequality? I mean,
yes.
It just seems on the face of it, the more inequality, the more. What? Well, there's a couple of different effects. I'll just leave it there with that question. The other thing is the whole question, I mean, property, it seems like the whole talk is around what we would think of as consumer goods. So, you know, if you take the people who are, let's say, in the upper 0.1%.
Yeah. Not
what
that.
Percentage? Yeah, not people with $100,000 income. No. I mean.
Right.
If you take people or upper 5.5% or something like that, I mean, what percentage of their wealth is in luxury goods versus other kinds of assets? And I mean, I wonder
if
with the rise of the whole modern finance and, you know, joint stock companies or public corporations, whether the whole problem of luxury isn't sort of radically transformed, that people with really a lot of money have a lot of options. They can buy all kinds of assets that aren't the things that we normally think of as luxury goods.
No, because investment is a way of using your money for the common good if you invest in something that actually benefits the society, right? Investment is something that generates goods for the society, generates things that the society needs, assuming you're investing in things that the society actually needs. So to invest your money is for the common good. The question is, what are you investing it in? Are you investing it in something good? And that would be a different question. I think that the challenge of inequality and the challenge of the super wealthy is that none of us live in the super wealth. Okay, I'm being presumptuous. I don't live in the super wealthy world. Most people do not live in the 1% world. This is where all the wealth is in our society. The 1%, there's only 1% of them. Right? I mean, the 1% will always be with you, Jesus could say. What's interesting is that our 39%, like the next two quintiles, you have a lot of money. There's a lot of money there, right? I did a calculation one time. The people from 2% to 40% in the income ladder control 57% of the resources in the society. The 1% control 19%. Okay. Three times more is controlled by people who are like this, and which is more like us, right? And these are the people who set the standards for these people, right? Most people who are making $50,000, they can't imagine living like the 1%, right? But they can imagine living like their doctor. And so how their doctor lives actually has a big effect on how we perceive income inequality. If their doctor lives modestly, then asking people who make $50,000 to live modestly is okay. But if their doctor lives extravagantly, then obviously people who work here at the 50,000 level will say, well, why can't I live like my doctor? A fair question. So I think part of the problem with inequality is that we don't always think in these terms, and we're always kind of reaching way up here, which there are questions up there, but there's an awful lot of excess money in this area that I think is needed to really overcome the problem of inequality in our society.
Yeah, my question follows Dr. Fleming's question a little bit about security in the future. I'm wondering whether you have any advice for us as individuals, given that we live in a luxury-focused society, on how to get outside perspective on our own inclinations, given that many of us may be tempted to try to hedge against future insecurity and right. think that that's totally normal, right? We're just thinking, yes. Oh, I'm laying away savings for the future because that's what I have to do. How do we get outside perspective on how to weigh our own judgment and how to know when we're crossing some sort of line and we're maybe giving too much weight to our own fears about the future? How do we consider the lilies, for example, in our life and know how to do that prudentially?
Yeah, I don't think this is actually the same problem. I'm going to use my father again. I'm sorry, anecdotes are effective here. My father's a saver, right? And my mother's also a saver, but my mother's an anxious saver, which I think gets to Dr. McCrory's question about an anxious saver doesn't even spend money on necessities sometimes, but in fact is overly stingy because they're anxious about events that might happen in the future. Right? And I make that point because I don't think that's actually the vice of luxury. Right? I think that that's a different kind of problem. I think in Christian terms it would be an issue about trusting in God and in other people. Right? The most important thing... the most important thing for us, whatever happens to our society over the next 5 days, 5 months, 5 years, the most important thing is to trust in God. And then the second most important thing is to use your dishonest wealth to make friends. People. which is actually consistent with the luxury critique, which is using your money to foster personal relationships. Even though this sounds kind of nepotistic, it's actually very consistent with the gospel, right? And so our ultimate shelter is the relationships that we have, not the amount of money in our 401k. And I have enough of my mother's anxious saver in me as well to like have to say that to myself as well, to say that's not really what it's about, ultimately.
I think this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for a great talk.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by David Cloutier, professor of theology in the Department of Theology at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., and author of Love, Reason, and God's Story, An Introduction to Catholic Sexual Ethics, and Walking God's Earth, The Environment and Catholic Faith. He spoke on the topic, The Vice of Luxury, Economic Excess in a Consumer Age. His remarks were given as part of Creighton's Business, Faith, and Common Good lecture series. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, November 1st, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.